and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Religious Liberty Summit held today at the Department of Justice, presided over by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who announced the formation of a Religious Liberty Task Force to fight a holy war against an unnamed dangerous movement underway in this country, which is eroding the rights of American Christians to worship. Rachel Lazar, the President and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, joins us to discuss Sessions' dog whistle appeal to bigotry in the name of religious liberty, as the Attorney General of the United States cited Christians as victims, with the fictional example of nuns being ordered to buy contraceptives. Sessions also offered another example of trespass against Christian freedom in America, with Senator Dianne Feinstein's alleged attack on religious liberty referring to her suggestion that, quote, dogma lives loudly within you, as she questioned a nominee for the Seventh Circuit, Amy Coney Barrett, who was recently on the shortlist to replace Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court. The Attorney General then praised Jack Phillips, a member of the new task force's panel of Christian fundamentalist activists on display at the DOJ today, whose claim to fame is that he refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple, an example of religious persecution. Sessions claimed, quote, "We've all seen the ordeal that he, Phillips, faced bravely." Then we will speak with Jeff Stein, the national security correspondent for Newsweek, who writes the Spy Talk column. He joins us to discuss his article at Newsweek, How Vladimir Putin Will Take Down Donald Trump When He's No Longer Useful, and the recent coverage of Trump in the Russian press, where he has been widely referred to as our president. But now, following Trump's pathetic deference to Putin at Helsinki, is now described in the state-controlled Russian press with a mixture of concern, pity, and ridicule. Then finally, we'll assess the elections today in Zimbabwe, the first without the longtime dictator who wrecked and plundered the country, Robert Mugabe, on the ballot. Ambassador John Campbell, a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, who was political counselor at the U.S. Embassy during South Africa's first non-racial election and is the author of Mourning in South Africa, joins us. We'll discuss the generational challenge the 40-year-old Nelson Chamisa represents as he tries to unseat the general in charge of security who removed Mugabe in a coup, 75-year-old Emmerson Mnangagwa, known as the Crocodile, for his decades-long service of feeding Mugabe's opponents to the crocodiles. And joining us now is Rachel Lazar, who's the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a lawyer. She has spent the past two decades fighting for inclusivity for all Americans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Lazar.
Thank you, Ian. Nice to be back.
Well, thank you, Rachel. And today, Attorney General Jeff Sessions declared a holy war against a dangerous movement to erode the rights of American Christians to worship. Now, what is this dangerous movement that Sessions is talking about?
It's hyperbole, and it's wrong, and it's offensive to the true meaning of religious freedom, actually. It's a perceived threat that I think Sessions named himself when he said Americans from a wide variety of backgrounds are concerned about what this changing cultural climate means for the future of religious liberty in this country. I think he's talking about a change in demographics, right? We know that starting in 2014, white Christians were no longer a majority in America. And we know that what's coming soon is a landscape where white people will no longer be a majority in America. And there's a lot of concern, frankly, that's about preserving the power of Christian fundamentalists. And that's what this event today exposed.
And the event today, of course, is the Religious Liberty Summit at the Justice Department, presided over by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who announced the formation of a Religious Liberty Task Force. So at this Justice Department event today, Jeff Sessions said, "We've seen nuns ordered to buy contraceptives. We've seen U.S. senators ask judicial and executive branch nominees about dogma, even though the Constitution explicitly forbids a religious test for public office. We've all seen the ordeal faced so bravely, by Jack Phillips. Now, he's the baker, right?
That's right, in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. That's right.
Who's essentially a bigot. So what's so brave about being a bigot?
That's right. No, I mean, what we're really seeing is this white Christian fragility and this sort of taint that they're putting on our resistance to using religion as a basis to override our collective American civil rights laws. So what we're talking about is one America where we not only have these constitutional protections for religious freedom for all, which means everyone is free to believe whatever they want or not believe, right? But then we also, as a country, pass laws collectively that we deem to be American laws, no one's specific religion laws, but American laws. And what these folks want to do, and scary enough, including our country's president and our administration, is carve out these religious exemptions. And in other words, establish the religion of these sort of really right-wing, extreme Christian fundamentalists. And what we're saying is this is dangerous to the core of who America is, because we're intentionally a diverse country. We've welcomed in people of all different religions and all different kinds, and that if we are getting to the point where we need to assert the dominance of one group, that we will cease to be America as it was intended to be. You know, no one's saying that we've always lived up to our ideals, right? We've got a lot of ideals in this country embedded in our Constitution that we all know we have never achieved and we're still working towards. But today's summit and what's going on from this administration is truly offensive and a disgrace, because it's creating an America where there isn't religious freedom for all. There's just religious freedom for some, and we know who that some is, right? It's, frankly, a lot the base that Trump, Pence are pandering to. And today was the perfect example. If you want to sort of see it visually and point to an example, it was a one-sided and stacked panel today at the summit that you just described, with these speakers like Jack Phillips of Masterpiece Cake Shop and of Bethany Christian Services. This is a private foster agency that stopped getting referrals from Philadelphia County because they discriminate against same-sex couples. There's Cornerstone Schools, which is a Christ-centered charter school in D.C. Where's the panel with the women at Notre Dame who no longer are having their birth control covered by insurance because of the Trump-Pence rules against women being able to get their birth control in the name of religion? Where are Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple who was denied the right to have their wedding cake made by a baker on the basis of his personal religious views? Where are the American Muslims who aren't able to rejoin with their spouses or get their parents over here to take care of them because there's discrimination happening in this country in order to maintain a white Christian America, right? I mean, this was a one-sided panel and another aggressive move in the Trump-Pence regressive agenda to give power to one segment of Christians in this country.
And again, I'm speaking with Rachel Lazar, who is the president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a lawyer. She has spent the past two decades fighting for inclusivity for all Americans. And the charity that you mentioned that deals with foster children, isn't that the one that Betsy DeVos funds that are taking in some of these kids being separated from their parents at the southern border?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's who's on our panel from our federal government. And the two folks who were named as chair for this task force, these two senior officials from the Department of Justice, Jesse Panuccio, I think is his name, and Beth Williams. Well, Jesse Panuccio is one of the lawyers in support of Prop 8, which you're all too familiar with in California, California's same-sex marriage ban. So, I mean, these are the folks right now who are leaders in our government. Unless anyone felt that, well, you know, we've got sort of these extremists at the top, but they haven't really filtered down in terms of who's implementing these rules. Well, these are the folks now who are charged with implementing the Department of Justice blueprint that they created last year about religion being used to discriminate. And I don't know if your listeners know a lot about that blueprint, but that blueprint specifically says that taxpayer dollars can be used to discriminate in hiring, even though it's government funding. Not only that, and that's bad enough, but that blueprint that this task force is being charged to implement also suggests that this approach can be expanded to allow taxpayer dollars to be used to discriminate in who you serve and what service you provide. So just let me give a couple of examples. A homeless shelter could refuse to take in a gay teenager. You know, one of the folks who are most in need of housing in this country, or a social service agency that serves sex trafficking victims who are often victims of sexual abuse can refuse to take women for reproductive services. And this blueprint that this task force has been charged with implementing was intended last year when it came out to be a blueprint for all parts of the government to use religion as a basis for discrimination, which is what we've seen with so many of the regulations coming out of the Department of Health and Human Services this year, including this birth control regulation that I just referenced when I was talking about the Notre Dame students that gives all bosses and universities the right to deny birth control to women based on their personal religious views, not the women's.
Sure.
I mean, the universities are the bosses.
Right, and that's likely to, with Kavanaugh on the court, that will even strengthen the conservative lobby.
You know, we actually have proof of that, because one of the cases that Kavanaugh wrote a dissent in his short time on the D.C. Circuit Court was a case called Priests for Life, which was about birth control and sort of the government's compromise that said religious nonprofits could get out of themselves giving women birth control so long as they signed a one-page waiver that let it just go to an insurance company to deal with, so they didn't have to have anything to do with it. And what Judge Kavanaugh said in his dissent was, that's too much, that's a burden on religious nonprofits, religious liberty. And he disagreed in his dissent with 8 of 9 circuit courts across the country, including the D.C. Circuit. That's how extreme he is. So you're right on this very issue. If you're worried that what this administration is trying to do in every way possible is to allow religion to be used to discriminate and to cause harm and really to advance a conservative political agenda, that is exactly what's going on.
And, of course, abortion would not be an issue if contraceptives were easily available and the morning after pill. So these people are hypocrites in this much.
They are. If you want to reduce the need for abortion, then you need to expand, not restrict, access to birth control.
Sure.
Right? In this country, over half of unintended pregnancies end in abortion, or around half. So it's so obvious that if you cut down on the unintended pregnancies, which largely, not entirely, but is about access to birth control, then you have a reduction in the number of abortions in this country. It's absolutely hypocritical.
So at this Religious Liberty Summit today at the Department of Justice, presided over by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who announced the formation of a task force, the Religious Liberty Task Force, whatever they'll do, I don't know. But let me just quote some more of what Sessions said today. Let's be frank, a dangerous movement undetected by many is challenging and eroding our great tradition of religious freedom. There can be no doubt it's no little matter. It must be confronted intellectually and politically and be defeated. This last election gives us a rare opportunity to arrest these trends and to confront them. So again, this is a dog whistle, no specifics about what this dangerous movement is, but what's he signaling here?
I mean, he is signaling what I think Jeff Sessions also said later, which is that this is about the changing cultural climate, and this is about giving power to Trump's base. That's what this is about. And it's about sort of keeping America, you know, and preserving white Christian power in this country, and frankly, pandering to that segment of political conservatives in this country. That's what this is really about.
Right, but is it also a dog whistle saying that gays and lesbians and minorities are taking over? Is that what?
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many changes, right? I mean, what this backlash, right, that's described by Sessions as a dangerous movement. What's the dangerous movement? That's having a black president, the first black president in this country, that's having marriage equality in this country, that's women rising up and coming out with in more force than ever, running for office, right? It's all the social changes, right? The changes towards inclusivity, the changes towards progress, the kinds of steps that when America has taken them as a country, we've never looked back at them as wrong, ultimately. We've always viewed them as the right direction for America, right? But then there's this narrow-minded force that is trying to, you know, stand and yell stop to all this social change. And, you know, I think it's all the things that we just talked about and also the changing demographics in this country on top of it.
Well, just in the last minute, let me ask you about, I don't know whether you read, Rachel, the New York Times Sunday article about Mike Pence, basically saying that if you get rid of Trump, you got something even worse in Mike Pence. He's a really scary and dangerous guy. Do you share that idea that he's behind what Sessions is talking about here, along with Betsy DeVos? So that would be quite a triumvirate, wouldn't it? President Pence, Attorney General Sessions, and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos?
It would be on religious freedom issues as they're defined in their true meaning, it would be devastating, absolutely, which is why, you know, I think one of the most important things that people can do in this next election is get out and vote their values. I mean, I just think it couldn't be more important but to get out and vote your values, because there are real effects to not showing up at the voting booth right now, and it's a very dangerous moment for this country. Can I make a pitch and also tell people to join AU, Americans United for Separation of Church and State? We're very, very hard at work, and we're the only national group whose sole mission is dedicated to the separation of church and state, and we are on it, but we really need, you know, to continue to grow our movement of Americans United and not Americans Divided. And if you go to AU.org, you can join us, and we'd love to have you by our side, because we all need to come together in moments like this. These are scary moments for our country.
Well, Rachel Lazar, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Very nice to speak with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Rachel Lazar, who's president and CEO of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, a lawyer. She has spent the past two decades fighting for inclusivity for all Americans. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking into how Vladimir Putin will take down Donald Trump when he's no longer useful.
When the president talks to God, do they drink near beer and go play golf? While they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade when the president talks to God. When the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not? That voice is just inside his head when he kneels.
I'm a spy in the house of love. I know the dream that you're dreaming of.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeff Stein, the national security correspondent at Newsweek and author of the Spy Talk column, which was launched in 2005. It's a weekly column at the Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007. And he's the author of Murder in Wartime, the untold story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. And his latest article at Newsweek is How Vladimir Putin Will Take Down Donald Trump When He's No Longer Useful. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Stein.
Thank you.
And I guess I don't know that the American public, as much as we're tribalized and in these alternative silos where Donald Trump's people who watch Fox News and Sinclair believe that everything that the mainstream media prints is lies and only he speaks the truth, and then alternatively, most of the mainstream media are questioning Donald Trump's veracity on a daily basis. But in Russia, I think it's worth looking at the way the Russian media see Donald Trump. And for the longest time, my understanding is that they refer to him in Russia as our president. Is that something that you picked up on too?
Yeah, well, as I said in my recent column, there's a mix of responses to Trump's performance. There has been a mix over time, and it changes. But after the really startling Helsinki meeting between Putin and Trump, commentators on Moscow radio and TV commented with a mix of concern and pity and ridicule, as I wrote, and none of which could have been uttered without the Kremlin's approval. So one of the ways they can discredit Trump is to call him our president. So there's been a shift in tone recently, in which seems to signal that they may be hedging their bets on Trump. You have to remember that Trump has been a very good vehicle for the Russians for many reasons over the past couple of years for advancing Russia's goals to take down the United States. If he's no longer effective, then they'll dump him because the target is always the U.S. It has been since the Cold War. And, you know, conversely, our goal was to take down the Soviet Union. So they are proceeding according to their traditional aims. And Trump has been a very useful tool for them.
So I assume that one has to go back to before the elections, where everybody thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win, including, I believe, Donald Trump, because he didn't prepare a victory speech. So the presumption would be that Putin also expected Hillary Clinton to win, but obviously invested in much as he could in Donald Trump. And we'll find out, presumably, the full extent of the various threads of his influence operation. But wouldn't it be logical then, from Putin's point of view, if he thought Hillary Clinton was going to win, that he still would find Donald Trump useful as a leader of the opposition to basically go around the country and lead rallies with the chant, lock her up, lock her up, to divide America and to limit Hillary Clinton's ability to govern?
Absolutely. The Russian messages, as I hinted at earlier, the Russian propaganda operations against the U.S. have been, you know, beamed at us for 75 years. And they just never made much of a dent here. There was some influence success. There were some influence successes during the Vietnam War where they could capitalize on widespread deep protest against the war. The same with civil rights. But Americans generally, you know, supported their government or supported the notion of American democracy. And they never had a real good horse to ride until Trump came along. This was a really quantitative and qualitative change in their operations. So that's where the Russians have scored some big successes. Had not Trump won, they would have continued to look for other vehicles to undermine our political stability. So just have to remember that its goal is to weaken the United States and the Western alliance. And they've just never been particularly successful at it until Trump came along.
And it seems that they're continuing, though, in active measures, particularly in terms of election meddling, because we've had reports now that Claire McCaskill's campaign in Missouri has been under attack by the Russians. Now, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? She's probably number one on Donald Trump's hit list of the senators he's trying to knock off, along with Heidi Heitkamp and Joe Manchin.
Yeah, and she's a good target because she's a key player on Capitol Hill and homeland security issues. She's been constantly expressing worries that we have not, under the Trump administration, have not organized our cyber defenses in particular. The Trump White House abolished the position of cyber czar, and each agency is taking measures on its own. But you really need White House direction on an issue like this, which crosses across so many different intelligence and military agencies. And so McCaskill was a very valuable target for the Russians, and of course they would go after her.
Well, but this is extraordinary, isn't it, when you think that it's the meddling and is ongoing from the 2016 election, has been denied consistently by President Trump, even though his own government's had to accept the reality of it. They had their first White House National Security Council meeting on election tampering and what to do about it, and the meeting had about 15 principals gathered for the first time, and it only lasted for 30 minutes. So it was clearly a farce.
Yeah, what came out of the reports on that indicate that Trump had a very diffident attitude during the meeting. He listened. He didn't really engage. Of course, there's a question of how much he really knows about it or really cares about how government functions. But nothing came out of it. There were no new initiatives. And people responsible for the security of the United States are pulling their hair out. And I talk to friends outside of our little media bubble who are generally well-informed about the news, follow it fairly closely. And when they've asked me about this stuff, they are alarmed to learn that we've let our defenses down. There is no coordinated effort out of the White House to shore up our cyber defenses, in particular protection of the 2018 elections. This is really a dereliction of duty, and it's very alarming. And I have to say that I don't think it's really caught on with the public at large. It's focused more narrowly on this drama between Trump and Robert Mueller, the special counsel, like a thriller. Will he get him? Will Trump get away with the crime? Will the prosecutor get him? That's been the focus of most Americans, and it doesn't matter what their opinions are, if they're Trump supporters or anti-Trump. That's the drama that's really drawn the attention. Whereas the more important issue, one could argue, is whether we are defending ourselves. And that hasn't really caught on, I think.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Stein, who's a national security correspondent at Newsweek, who writes the Spy Talk column, which was launched in 2005 as a weekly column at the Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007. He's the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. And his latest article at Newsweek is How Vladimir Putin Will Take Down Donald Trump When He's No Longer Useful. So, my assumption is that the FBI, and I assume the CIA, perhaps the NSA as well, have fairly substantial files on Donald Trump over the years. But more importantly, the Russians must have really, I think, fairly voluminous files on him, because he's been there since, 1987, when he went with his wife, who acted as a translator, Ivana Trump. She's a Czechoslovak and grew up behind the so-called Iron Curtain. The Trump kids basically spent every summer, as far as I know, behind the Iron Curtain while they were growing up. So they must have been on the Russian intelligence services radar, surely.
That's right. Just like our intelligence services take note of any prominent foreigner who's visiting our country, the Russians took note of Donald Trump when he first visited. He was famous then, or notorious, depending on how you want to look at it. And of course they would take interest in it. They would want to know who he is. They would want to arrange personal meetings and take away from those meetings psychological profiles of him. Can he be useful? What's he doing here? What does he want? And so the Russians almost certainly began assessing Donald Trump as a someone who might be useful to them in the future in many ways, and some quite benign, investments and so on. But when Trump began to emerge as a kind of a radical commentator on social issues in the United States, for example, demanding that the innocent young black boys who were accused of wilding in Central Park, beating up on a young woman, when he began taking out full-page ads that they should be prosecuted, they would have taken note of that. of course, his main line of attack on Obama, that he wasn't an American citizen. Trump was a prominent birther. So our intelligence agencies would have taken note that Trump's public positions were in a line with the Russians many years ago. They would have had some concern about that beyond normal politics. So, you know, Trump has just emerged. If he's not in collusion with the Russians, his interests and the Russians' interests have been parallel for a long time.
So why would then they want to ditch him? Or we know that there's a great deal of suspicion. The former head of the CIA, John Brennan, believes that the Russians have something on him personally. The former director of national intelligence has described Putin as Trump's case officer, which is pretty damning. Given that he is a divisive character and he's loved and loathed in this country along those divisions, and there's no reconciling as far as I can tell, and on a daily basis he pulls off stunts. I mean, the very fact, by the way, in that press conference at Helsinki that alarmed a lot of people, the fact that Trump said that Putin had made an incredible offer, and it turned out to be, the incredible offer turned out to be handing over a former U.S. ambassador, not to mention Bill Browder, who Putin desperately wants to get his hands on. I mean, what does that say about Trump, for God's sake? Is this man really that stupid, do you think, or that ill-informed?
You know, this is the enduring mystery about Trump. Obviously, people are very reluctant to see him as the Manchurian candidate, a guy, the president of the United States, being an active, willing tool of a foreign government, in this case, the Russians, who are our number one adversary. You know, that's just too horrendous an idea for people to get their hands around. And we don't have any proof of that. But what we do, you cited all the reasons that make us worry that he is, in fact, a tool of the Russians, that he is a Russian agent. And we got to be cautious about, you know, making these charges, but they are what they are. The evidence is what it is. And it's hard to escape what's become apparent, that he's acting in Russian interests. You ask, you know, is he really dumb? I don't think he's dumb. I think he's reactive, almost like an amoeba, to heat and cold and light and darkness. And his immediate concern is his own survival in the face of these multiple investigations of him and his associates. And however he can change the subject from the Mueller investigation, he'll do it. There is some suggestion that he has aligned himself with Russia on the advice of Henry Kissinger, the former Nixon National Security Advisor and Secretary of State. You know, your more astute listeners will remember that Kissinger engineered the American alliance with rapprochement with China against the Soviet Union. And Kissinger reportedly has advised Trump to make an alliance of sort with Russia against China. So that may inform some of Trump's decision making. But we know from the boasts of Trump's own sons that they got a lot of money from the Russians. That's a quote, I think, a lot of money from the Russians when Trump couldn't get any U.S. banks to loan to him anymore because of his multiple bankruptcies in Atlantic City and his generally shoddy business reputation in New York. So then you have, you know, the infamous Steele dossier, which alleges that the Russians have compromise or information that they can use to blackmail Trump's, which may include Trump's sexual activity in a Moscow hotel. I think Trump having undisclosed debts to the Russians is enough blackmail material. And in that Trump has refused to release his tax returns, that has fanned these suspicions even more. We can be sure that Special Counsel Mueller has those tax returns and is amassing that information as part of his likely accusation of Trump that he is acting as a Russian agent because of pressure from the Russians' disclosures that they would make about his finances.
Well, just in closing, Jeff Stein, if Trump is the gift that keeps on giving for Putin, why would Putin want to cut him loose?
Well, there may come. He's still very, very useful to them, and he proves to be useful day after day. But there are a lot of things that Trump, they're learning that Trump can't control. For example, sanctions. He can't unilaterally lift sanctions against Russia. Congress has a major role to play in that. And Congress is not likely to allow him to lift these sanctions. That's just for one thing. Congress has also voted to give lethal aid to Ukraine to fight the Russians. Congress is going to have a lot to say about tariffs and whose tariffs are applied and which ones are lifted. So if there comes a time when Trump is no longer so valuable to the Russians, or less valuable than he has been, signs are now that they're prepared to shift their focus to finding other horses they can ride, or just go back to their default position, which is to sow chaos in American politics. That's their main aim. Trump is useful, but controlling Trump is not their absolute priority. Their priority is to throw chaos into the American political system. As long as Trump keeps undermining American institutions like the FBI, the Justice Department, the courts, and so on, they'll keep riding him. But they're going to find every horse available to ride to create additional chaos in the American system. That's their goal.
And I think controlling Trump is a fool's errand. I don't think Trump can even control Trump. So I think they've got their work cut out there. I thank you for joining us, Jeff Stein.
You're welcome. Thank you for asking me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Stein, who's a national security correspondent at Newsweek, who writes a Spy Talk column, which was launched in 2005 as a weekly column at the Congressional Quarterly before it moved to the Washington Post in 2007. He's the author of A Murder in Wartime, the untold spy story that changed the course of the Vietnam War. And his latest article at Newsweek is How Vladimir Putin Will Take Down Donald Trump When He's No Longer Useful. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the elections today in Zimbabwe between a 40-year-old challenger and the 75-year-old Emmerson Mnangagwa, known as the Crocodile for his decades-long service of feeding Mugabe's opponents to the crocodiles. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ambassador John Campbell, who is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for African Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a career Foreign Service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria, and political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. His books include Nigeria, Dancing on the Brick, Mourning in South Africa, and his latest, Nigeria, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador John Campbell.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And what do you think of this election in Zimbabwe that seems to have generated a lot of enthusiasm amongst, I think, close to 6 million registered voters in a population of, I think, what, 17 million. There's a sense that this is the first time that people have been living under Mugabe now for 40 years can speak freely, even make jokes about Mugabe, and vote possibly for the opposition leader.
That's right. And, of course, the population of Zimbabwe is extremely young, so that for a very large percentage of voters, they have known no other head of state than Mugabe until the coup that forced Mugabe from office last year. The preliminary reports of the elections certainly talk about the enthusiasm of the electorate. I would caution, however, that preliminary reports, of course, come from urban areas because that's where the best communications are. About 63% of Zimbabwe's population is rural, and we really don't know at this stage much of anything about how the elections in rural areas are going.
Well, there's already complaints out there from the opposition of difficulties at polling places, paperwork and rolls that seem to be tampered with. What's your sense of freeness and fairness? There's the former leader of Liberia, I believe, is heading up a delegation of vote monitors.
She is indeed, for the National Democratic Institute. What's my sense of it? My sense of it is it's really way too early to make a judgment about what the magnitude is. That there are irregularities is almost certain. After all, there are almost always election irregularities, polls opening late, ballots not being delivered, and so forth. There are almost always election irregularities. For that matter, even in first world countries such as our own. The issue is, are we talking about something which is really very minor, or are we talking about something which is significant, and it's just too soon to tell? I note with interest that the head of the European Union observers said that in some places the elections appear to have gone extremely well. In other places, they were absolutely chaotic, with people leaving the lines out of disgust. His observation strikes me as really quite credible. It's easy to imagine a process that is extremely variable. I would also comment in passing that in my experience with African observer missions, the European Union's tends to be really quite credible and quite professional.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a career foreign service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria, political counselor to the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. His books include Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, Mourning in South Africa, and his latest, Nigeria, What Everyone Needs to Know. So just looking at the candidates for a minute, the crocodile, as he's called, Emmerson Mnangagwa, the head of the ZANU-PF party. He's the fellow that basically forced Mugabe out of the ZANU-PF party, and out of office. And, of course, Mugabe held a press conference over the weekend urging his supporters to vote for the opposition to restore the country to constitutionality. That's a bit rich coming from Mugabe, is it not?
It is a bit rich. It is also interesting to me that Mugabe actually used the coup word, something everybody has sort of tiptoed around up until now.
So what do we know about the crocodile? My understanding is that Emmerson Mnangagwa, the head of the military who deposed Mugabe and who is running as head of the party to be the next leader, first of all, isn't his nickname based upon the fact that he fed opposition leaders and dissidents to the crocodiles on behalf of Mugabe?
That indeed is what is said on the street. Whether he actually fed opposition leaders to crocodiles or not, I don't know. What is quite clear, though, is he was Mugabe's enforcer. Many observers of Zimbabwe feel that he's up to his elbows in blood. An interesting question is, can somebody who was, in many respects, the linchpin of the Mugabe system, can it move the country in a different direction? Mnangagwa says yes, that he can do that. And he has launched a charm offensive ever since he came into office. A charm offensive directed, however, predominantly towards outside investors. He's clearly seeking foreign investment to try to restore the country's economy, which is in tatters. Credible elections would bolster that effort. We will have to see.
Well, I think foreign aid is predicated upon credible elections, isn't it?
It is, yes. And also the lifting of sanctions against Zimbabwe. We have to be careful, though. Foreign aid and sanctions are important symbolically. They're important politically. But they're not nearly as important as opening the taps of investment into the Zimbabwean economy would be.
So the fact that Mugabe, at age 94, urged his followers to vote for the opposition, he doesn't have a lot of credibility, does he not? I mean,
he does not have a lot of credibility.
And the fact that he tried to get his wife in there was really, wasn't that the tipping point?
That was the occasion for his being deposed. I would say that Mugabe is less popular now than he was at the time of the coup. For one thing, the corruption of many of his cronies has come out since then. He lives in incredibly luxurious circumstances in a country that is desperately poor. So I don't really think that there's much of a Mugabe factor here. I think he is seen by the more than half of the electorate that is under 35 as being very much a figure of the past.
Well, let's talk about the opposition leader of the MDC alliance. That's Nelson Chamisa. He became an MP at the age of 25, a cabinet minister at 31. He could be the youngest president of Zimbabwe, aged 40. That's certainly a break from the 94-year-old Mugabe. He apparently was beaten up by Mugabe's security forces. Had his skull fractured in 2007. He's recently become a pastor, and he also apparently has, on the stump, has been making some rather extravagant promises, introducing a high-speed bullet train. Well, here in California, our high-speed bullet train is floundering. I don't know what the chances are of getting one in Zimbabwe, and also bringing the Olympics to Zimbabwe. So what do you know about this young challenger, Nelson Chamisa?
Well, his background is certainly interesting. By the way, in addition to what you mentioned, he is also a lawyer. He is well educated. He is a Pentecostal preacher. Pentecostalism is spreading like wildfire in Zimbabwe, as it is in other parts of southern Africa. And should he win election as president, not only would he be the youngest president of Zimbabwe, he would also be the youngest president of any country in Africa. So he certainly represents a generational change. His policy pronouncements, his promises, I don't think we should pay very much attention to that. I think more important would be his style of governance, his willingness to govern according to the rule of law, something which has been extraordinarily absent in Zimbabwe up until now. those are the sorts of things that I think would be really, really significant. Politics in Zimbabwe, like in most African countries, is very personal. Personality matters, not policy. And it will be interesting to see if the evident enthusiasm of his supporters actually translates into votes. I would point out that altogether, there are more than 20 candidates for the presidency at this point. That means that the chances of either of the two leading candidates getting the required 50% of the total vote, it strikes me as those chances are not really very good. And what that would mean would be a runoff election between the two leading vote-getters, who would almost certainly be Mnangagwa and Chinso.
But basically, ZANU-PF have a bigger constituency, don't they, in the middle of the country. And then in the south, the Matabeleland, that's where the MDC alliance has its stronghold. And the MDC alliance, of course, represents the very people who've been persecuted by ZANU-PF. I think over 20,000 Matabeles were murdered when Mugabe took over.
That's right.
So is there a chance of defections in ZANU-PF land?
Well, we will have to see. Look, the Mnangagwa has got some real advantages. He controls the security services. The Electoral Commission reports to him. He controls the state media. He knows how to play the ethnic card. My own view is that he would prefer not to have to rig the elections. In other words, he'd prefer to win the elections cleanly. But if it looks like he is going to lose, then I would look for rigging. If rigging takes place, it will take place not on election day, not at the polls. The way you rig an African election is when the various vote tallies are bought together. That's usually done in the middle of the night when there are no observers present. That's when you can play games. And if, in fact, the elections are rigged in Zimbabwe, I think that's when it will take place.
Well, already the MDC is saying if we're robbed, we're going to go to the streets. So that's a sort of combustible situation. I think the real message, though, surely something that you can't even exaggerate it so bad, is what Mugabe has done to that country, shattering the economy, the most amazing inflation, making Weimar Germany look like a picnic, unemployment absolutely devastating, and crumbling infrastructure. I could go on. So that has to be the subtext, surely, there. The people have really suffered under Mugabe, and it's extraordinary to think that the ruling party, Mugabe's ruling party, would even be in the lead, given the country's history.
Yeah, but then back to history. What did Mugabe do? Well, Mugabe drove all the whites out. He expropriated their land. He redistributed some of the white-owned land to African peasant farmers. It's one reason why he's so popular in rural districts. He absolutely destroyed the economy. And Zimbabwe went from being one of the most developed African countries to what is now essentially a basket case, with almost a third of the population living outside of its borders. But history, memories of colonialism, appeals to racism, they're all in there. People react in a way that is often not rational economically.
Well, does that mean then, Ambassador Campbell, that Mugabe at 94, when he passes, he'll be thought of more favorably than he is now? Is that what's going to happen? He'll go down in the history books as the liberator, not as the looter.
Well, he already is viewed as the liberator in important parts of African public opinion. Mugabe, for example, was a critic of Nelson Mandela. Mugabe claimed that what Nelson Mandela did was sell out the majority of South Africa's population, which is black, in order to accommodate the 9% of the population that is white. And this criticism is in circulation in radical circles in South Africa even now. How long is Mugabe going to live? I would note that his mother lived to be 103, so he may be around for a few more years.
Well, just in closing, when you say there's some sympathy in radical circles in South Africa for the idea that the almost deified Nelson Mandela was a sellout to the whites, surely that has to be balanced against what happened with his successors in government, who turned out to be total crooks in the tradition, the lamentable tradition of the big men of Africa politics. Isn't that pretty much the case with Jacob Zuma?
Now, that was the case with Jacob Zuma, not the case with Thabo Mbeki, however. So that the issue really is, was Jacob Zuma utterly corrupt? Is he an exception to the general South African rule? My own view is that yes, he is, and that what is really interesting about South Africa is that the country's democratic and legal institutions were strong enough to carry it through a period of very bad governance.
Right, but the point is that Zuma had more in common with Mugabe, so it's a little hard to take that kind of criticism seriously from Mugabe. That Mandela...
Well, he did have close ties with Mugabe,
exactly.
And Zuma, in effect, really never criticized Mugabe. Even when South Africa was being having to respond to huge refugee flows from Zimbabwe.
Well, Ambassador Campbell, let's stay in touch, and we'll see how the results are. It may be.
Yeah, we'll see how the results are. I don't think we will really have a very clear picture before roughly a week from now.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, a career Foreign Service officer and former ambassador to Nigeria, political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. His books include Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, Mourning in South Africa, and his latest, Nigeria, What Everyone Needs to Know. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.